It's hard to say. I think the most exciting thing is the open access content is just going to balloon in volume.
This is a time when we should be really confident about the science that we're publishing and the content that's getting out to people. And I think ChatGPT poses significant challenges in that regard.
Yes, we acknowledge the threat, but I think at the same time, there are probably opportunities here as well.
One of the best things about working at Citizen Bricks is the technologists that we have are curious and amazingly talented and interesting individuals.
Thank you for joining us again. This is a continuation of the previous episode. As always, here's your host, Nikesh Gosalia.
But just to talk about, and I think it's great that you've shared a perspective on maybe the so-called dangers and at the same time, the optimistic side of things. I think I read a survey which probably sounds quite outdated now, but 3 or 4 weeks back where Forbes said that 89% of students are already using ChatGPT in some form or the other. And then obviously after that, a lot of universities have come up with, you know, policy changes, advising not to use. I think a lot of publishers and societies have also kind of made that as a policy. Just from the perspective of maybe a student, or to be more specific, a researcher, what potentially could be possible use cases of ChatGPT in your daily work?
Yeah, we've given quite a ChatGPT response to the question about what we think. On the one hand, this, some people say this, other people say this. Yeah, the question about it being used in research is an interesting one, and it's a really useful tool for making a start on something, isn't it? For doing your 70-80% of it and fine-tuning. And I think publishers will need to think about how using tools like this is, how it can be an accepted part of the production of research without kind of handing the production fully over to these kind of tools. Because there's a question, you know, there's a whole question here about IP, of everything that's come before. I don't think we need to get into that particularly now. There's lots of people have been talking about that. But so it's really difficult to see how publishers can accept it into the environment and allow researchers to make the most of it without kind of compromising the things that underpin what academic publishing is about, looking after the rights of the work. And also bolstering the integrity of research that's published. There's a use case that I'm interested in, which is how ChatGPT and similar could be used to make global research picture more inclusive and more accessible to researchers not working in English as a first language. I've read and lots of things about how English as lingua franca is kind of a huge blocker and a huge obstacle to proper equity in the research landscape. And large language models could certainly make it easier for researchers who aren't working in English to publish things in English speaking journals and things. But maybe that's not the point. Maybe that's not what we should be doing. And actually, this is another case of using these tools in an inequitable system that just entrenches those issues again. It just makes English even more mainstream. And actually, should we be using these tools to produce multilingual outputs of the same research, so that anybody can submit any paper and it's published in any language, and it's, you know, you've got this amazing kind of multilingual research environment. So I think there's loads to work out. When we have the existing metrics for citations and research impact and English as lingua franca, just putting these tools on top of what already exists, I think that's limiting their potential hugely. And actually, if we use them to reimagine the whole system, that's really exciting.
As I said before, I think that these models have a role in tools to allow, you know, literature reviews to be conducted more speedily. I've read some software developers use ChatGPT as kind of a, what's termed a rubber duck. So someone to talk to who's not a person, to run ideas past and get feedback from. And sure, you know, perhaps it doesn't say anything particularly helpful or insightful, but just the process of conversing can often make you more aware of, you know, where you're going with an idea. So perhaps there's a role there. And I think as these models are able to run on more commodity hardware, then perhaps researchers will use them, you know, to, dare I say it, mine their own sort of pool of personal literature to remind themselves of, you know, where they read something, or just to make their literature, their kind of corpus of literature a little bit more accessible, and maybe ask questions of it that they would not otherwise.
I read about a use case that somebody had posited of using ChatGPT in that kind of rubber duck way to work out what's my next research project, you know, what's missing in the literature, which is kind of neat, but also it feels like it kind of misses the point of impactful science, which is to solve factual problems. And ChatGPT can't understand what actual problems are because it just can't do that. So again, it's kind of that kind of funneling down to, well, this is missing, so it must be a problem that needs to be solved, but actually maybe nobody's published on it because it doesn't matter, nobody cares. So there's that. I don't see that that's a particularly useful use case. And more generally, the content generation piece, everybody's concerned about research integrity at the moment and paper mills and things, and this just seems like a ready-made tool to make life much more difficult to pick out what's good science and what's not. And going back to the role that publishers play in curating kind of the scholarly record and making sure good science gets out there, this is, you know, this is a time when we should be really confident about the science that we're publishing and the content that's getting out to people. And I think ChatGPT poses significant challenges in that regard.
That was interesting. I was just talking to a colleague of mine this morning, and he said, yes, we acknowledge the threat, but I think at the same time, there are probably opportunities here as well. There's probably importance of peer review. It's never been more vital. I think the other bit is that there was already so much content that is available out there. There's going to be push through open access. There's going to be push through content being created, maybe through tools like ChatGPT. And so then how do you make your content stand out, really? And so there's going to be a lot of evolution around those kind of things. You know, it could take the form of a video. It could take the form of a plain language summary, an infographic, visuals. And so, you know, yeah, there's going to be other opportunities that are going to emerge.
To bring things back to the kind of work that we do day to day, how can publishers create products and become product companies that get researchers to the good stuff and cut through, you know, if the record is flooded with spurious and bad science, how do we get researchers to the good stuff that they need to push us on and solve the next problems? And I think taking that product mindset and developing really exciting novel products and new content forms and things, I think it's a great opportunity. And it's, yeah, driven by threat. It feels like there's a lot of threat in the scholarly industry at the moment from various directions, and this is another one.
And one of those threats, I suppose, is the increasing importance of open access content. And I think here lies possibly the salvation, because, you know, the article is one piece of that. You know, it's the culmination of the research. But as if you start to open up other aspects of the research, such as the data set that underlie it, the methodology, the processes that were performed, then I'm not sure ChatGPT can do all of that, right? So by opening up the research and publishing and versioning and making and identifying more of the assets associated with the paper at the end, then you circumvent the problem of ChatGPT being able to generate loads of like plausible text.
Before we move on, and I promise Simon and Will that, you know, this will be the last question on ChatGPT. Very often the trends with the use of technology move, you know, very swiftly and exponentially. Things can change. And again, there's two schools of thought there. I think I was listening to a very senior ex-Googler who had one extreme of an opinion, saying machines will eventually take over. And what we feed in, so the input, the ethics, how to take care of bias, all of those things are really going to be important. And, you know, we have to really tackle that in the next few years. Otherwise, more or less, you know, everything's lost, kind of an opinion that, you know, this person had. And then there is a more kind of realistic picture that in some ways you started to paint, Simon, in that there could be so many open tools that we could add to it, and it could really start to become a more stronger, robust ecosystem with some real good use cases. And we can still have policies, we can still have, you know, things to keep things in check. So just very quickly, I mean, I don't know, how far do you think this will go in the next couple of years? Forget next 5 years.
It's hard to say. I think the most exciting thing is that OA, the open access content, is just going to balloon in volume. And then that's a data set, right? And previously, that content has been locked up in proprietary journals, and we're reliant on publishers to innovate and generate products. But as that content opens up and becomes more the predominant source of research, then the field is wide open for a new organization to leverage that data set. You know, what would a language model trained on academic research have to say? Interesting. What questions could it answer? What questions could you ask of it? And so again, I have to come back to open access as probably leading the next generation of products and applications of these tools.
Yeah, I think publishers really need to seize the moment and think about, really reimagine the role that they play in this ecosystem, which is going open and becoming a data set that powers these sort of language models and their applications. How can publishers become digital product companies that play a central role in that new environment? Because it is just so completely different to the late 90s or the early 2000s, where static content online as PDFs, and that's it. You know, this is a fundamentally different ball game, but I'm not sure that mindsets necessarily have caught up. And hopefully in the next couple of years, this is the moment that publishing kind of envisions its future, making the most of these things. And I think that's the really exciting stuff here. And at the moment, you know, people's use cases for ChatGPT feel incremental and not quite worth the buzz. But there is something, you know, just over on the horizon, something completely different. And I think that's really exciting.
Moving on, you folks also have something called Case Genie, which you developed in partnership with the Incorporated Council of Law Reporting for England and Wales. What exactly does Case Genie do, and how did you guys leverage AI machine tool learning in this tool?
So Case Genie is a useful tool because it breaks down, well, fundamentally, it breaks down the barrier to constructing the right search to find the documents that you're interested in. So one problem we come across quite often with professionals, so legal professionals or medical professionals, is that they are not necessarily used to using traditional search systems in the way that other professions may be. And Case Genie has the advantage of you being able to submit a document. So that could be a brief of a case, and it will generate search results based on the content within the brief. So it doesn't just use a keyword search, it generates word embeddings, which capture, you know, the notion, the semantic meaning of words in the document, and also allow you to match documents which may contain synonyms or may contain sentences which express the same kind of thing automatically. So you don't have to do that kind of mental gymnastics of expanding your search to match keywords that someone may have used in place of a different word that you're searching for. So it makes that process a whole lot easier. So technically how it works is we use FastText, which is another Facebook library, to generate these word embeddings for the document that the lawyer submits. And then we look for similar sentences and paragraphs within the corpus of content held by ICLR and surface those results as the initial search. And then the user can drill down using a more traditional search interface to hone in on exactly what they're looking for. And it has this notion of uncovering unknown unknowns. And I love it when the unknown unknown things come up, because everyone's like, well, you know, what's an unknown unknown? And I guess, you know, fundamentally it's a question you didn't know you had to ask, right? Or you weren't going to ask. Whereas a known unknown is something you know you don't know, so you can ask about it. So yeah, it's been viewed quite positively by the users. And I think it's a useful way of constructing a search, particularly for users who are less familiar with using traditional search interfaces.
We should maybe give a bit of background to ICLR, as they're, you know, slightly outside the scholarly and scientific world. They publish significant cases in England and Wales, so legal cases. If something that goes through the courts sets a new precedent or agrees with a landmark case or something, they will write a report about it and publish that. We built a delivery platform for those cases in 2017, 2018 that made them searchable and more kind of usable by lawyers. And the lawyers that we're talking about are solicitors who are doing research kind of about a new case, a new brief that they might have, and barristers who are putting arguments together to go and stand in court and make a case. But the reports are long and wordy and not necessarily easy to find the thing that you might want. And a barrister who's doing some work in family law, there may be some precedent in a different area of law, in I'm going to say ecclesiastical law because that's the one that's in my head, but it's a bit of a random example. Criminal law, but that's more mainstream. In criminal law, there may be something in a case in the 60s in criminal law which unlocks something in the case they're building in the family courts. But how do you find that? You know, how do you, you don't know what it is you're looking for, so you can't search it in a search box. It can't be tagged editorially in that way because it's a sort of esoteric concept. So using this approach means that lawyers can write a brief kind of skeleton argument, upload it to the system, and the system can see what's in there and what's important. Well, I'm anthropomorphizing it a bit, but it can see what's important in the case and then find things that are important in other cases and surface those cases. And there's no way that a lawyer could think, well, this case over here is going to be relevant to this case until that's happened without reading it themselves. It's a really interesting use case. It's kind of, it's equatable to researchers working in science and scholarly publishing, and it kind of feeds into interdisciplinary approaches to things. But yeah, it's a great use case, and it was a really exciting project to work on.
Very interesting. Thanks for that, Will. And I think you partly mentioned it already, but I just wanted to check with you that, do you see other use cases for this tool as well? So, I mean, just talking about very specifically the academic publishing industry, how do you think they might benefit from something like this? And I know you've already mentioned a bit, but if there's something more that might be useful for the listeners here.
Yeah, I think this kind of approach has use anywhere that we search for things and try to discover content, particularly when the corpus that we're searching might be kind of interdisciplinary or complex in some way. Yeah, I think there's huge potential across scientific publishing for this sort of approach to discovery. The word embedding approach effectively enriches the content that you've got, and it can be used for other use cases and flexibility to innovate in other ways, not just around discoverability. So yeah, it's effectively content enrichment that enables you to then think about other ways that you could use it in the future. And that's certainly the sort of thing that we're now looking at for ICLR. But yeah, I think that discovery use case. And actually, just thinking back to linking reviewers that we talked about at the top, that's, you know, it's a similar sort of thing. You're effectively taking a use case and a piece of content and linking the two. And that's discovery in a sense that's powered by these word embeddings.
And before we close, I just wanted to know from you all, so both Simon and Will, how do you keep yourself updated, both, I mean, as far as the academic publishing industry is concerned and technology is concerned? In the past, I've seen a lot of speakers have come up with some interesting ideas, and typically listeners benefit from it. No pressure, but if you have something that you do which is a bit unique, I mean, that might be helpful.
I suppose I'm quite traditional, really, so in terms of keeping up to date with stuff. So I read Hacker News, which is it's a really good source of latest technology news, but it can be a little bit impenetrable. I think it's good for developers to keep up to date with latest things, and it's good, I think, to parse it at a high level to identify trends. But other than that, you know, I try to be kind of up to date by, I follow, at the moment I'm following a YouTube playlist by someone called Andre Kapathy, who works at OpenAI, and he shows you how to build like a neural network. It's called Neural Networks from Zero to Hero. And I think I'm reasonably close to one of those at the moment. But you start from scratch and build a neural network, and then you build a simple system to generate content. And I haven't got to the end yet, but towards the end, you build a GPT implementation. I mean, it's not, you know, not going to be as good as GPT-3, but it's just, I guess, tracing that, being able to see that journey from simple beginnings to complex outcomes and follow that through. Okay, maybe I'll learn something about GPT-3, but I think I'll learn something about learning, you know, and I think that's the important thing, is to just be in the mindset of continually learning. I think that would be my takeaway.
I've been trying to think of some nuggets of wisdom that your listeners will find of value, and I'm going to struggle. So for technology kind of news, I mean, one of the best things about working at 67 Bricks is the technologists that we have are curious and amazingly talented and interesting individuals, all with slightly different interests across the kind of technology space. And really, what I learn about technology is from them. We have kind of internal forums and things to share knowledge about stuff that's taking people's interests. I don't read Hacker News or anything. I let Simon read Hacker News and then pass those sort of things on to me. So that, yeah, that's how I keep up with technology. Just a great bunch of talented developers in-house who keep on top of these things and make it interesting and accessible for less technical people like me. And in the publishing space, again, you know, we've got experts from across the industry at 67 Bricks, and learning about their experiences and conversations they're having with other people around the industry is great. I like conferences for seeing what people are up to. So things like ComTech in the autumn, find these sorts of things great to hear about the sort of innovations that publishers are going through and what developments like the Nelson Memo and Plan S actually mean, but for publishers on the ground and what they're doing about them. yeah, I like getting out to conferences and doing that. So, you know, nothing groundbreaking, but...
No, but that's good to hear. I mean, Simon, I think that was very interesting, especially the YouTube videos bit. I mean, I wasn't aware of it. So, you know, that was something new. And as far as conferences are concerned, that's refreshing to hear that, Will, because considering the fact that we almost for 2.5 years went into hybrid model. And after that, also, we were talking about, do we really need to meet people? But I think in my experience as well, over the last 6 months, we've seen conferences come back in a big way. And maybe we need to rethink whether we need to attend each and every conference. I don't think, you know, we can just completely get rid of, because there's still the whole element of, you know, just meeting people, talking about a variety of things. And you just can't do that on Zoom.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's been really nice to get back out and see people in person. And we've talked about some big challenges today. And I think the only way that you can really break through and work out how to approach these things is to share experiences and get together, and it just doesn't quite work in the same way in online conferences are good.
Thank you so much, Simon and Will. It's been an absolute pleasure. And to be honest, I was a little worried before we started in terms of how technology intensive this could get, but I think, yeah, thanks to both of you, Simon and Will, you know, you've made this really interesting, and I think a lot of listeners, including me, will find this really beneficial to understand more about the role of technology, role of ChatGPT in the future, some of the dangers that it poses, but at the same time, how can we embrace some of those tools and build on it? So yeah, thank you so much for making time.
Thanks, Nikesh. It's great to speak to you.
Thanks for having us along. It's been a pleasure.
Finally, thank you, listeners, for tuning in. If you like this episode, please subscribe to our channel on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. All Things ICOM is produced by a team which includes Sheng Fen, Anselm, Greg, and myself. Have a great week, and we'll see you all next time.
All Things ICOM is brought to you by Science Talks, a science media channel that aims to make science accessible to all. We publish articles, videos, podcasts, and magazines. To read a transcript of this episode or watch it on YouTube, visit sciencetalks.org. Also, write to us with your views, questions, and guest recommendations at contact@sciencetalks.org. Science Talks, bringing science to you.